The American public marches to the polls in a week. Will the weather be a help or a hindrance to voter turnout? We'll get the numbers from Professor Larry Jacobs of the University of Minnesota on how people have voted rain or shine in past elections. And we'll ask the builder, Tim Carter, on how to weatherize your home for the blustery months to come. The weather is on parade, and you're listening to Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. Welcome back, weather fans. I'm Kathy Werzer, host of Minnesota Public Radio's Morning Edition program. Paul Huttner is on assignment, but I am joined in studio by University of Minnesota meteorologist and climatologist Dr. Mark Seely and Minnesota Public Radio's own meteorologist Craig Edwards, who were just, both of these guys were marching around the studio. It was so cute to watch you guys.
Well, yeah, you had us marching in tune.
I did, actually.
I love that marching music.
Get in step is what I say. Well, in a week's time, friends, as I mentioned, American voters are going to head to the polls to elect their Congress members and also elect a president, and there's all kinds of local races. Will the weather around the country help or hurt the turnout, and what effects has the weather had on election results in the past? Good question, actually. Larry Jacobs is a professor of political science, and he's the Walter and Joan Mondale Chair for Political Studies at the University of Minnesota Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs. He's also director of the Humphrey Institute's Center for the Study of Politics and Governance, and he joins us to survey weather effects on voter turnout. How are you doing, Larry?
Great.
This is something completely different for you, I know, doing a weather program.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, it's one of those factors that we know matter. It's not widely studied. It's a little bit studied, but it's clearly an important consideration when you get down to Election Day and you think about who's actually going to turn out.
Has there been any evidence of adverse weather affecting turnout in Minnesota? We'll start with Minnesota first.
Well, you know, you go back to some elections, and it's kind of hard to control for everything in it. But there is a pattern where you get wetter, colder, snowier days. It tends to drop turnout. And it particularly hits harder the kind of voter who supports Democratic candidates.
Hmm. Really? I wonder why that is.
Well, it could be a variety of factors, including the fact that Democratic voters tend to have less income and tend to rely on public transport a bit more. Their interest and motivation sometimes isn't quite as high as those with more income. But in any case, you know, we tend to see a bit of a drop-off. You know, I wouldn't say it's kind of a huge impact, but it does play a role. And if you've got a close election, it can make all the difference in the world.
Northeast Minnesota, Larry, is an area that's been a Democratic stronghold over the years. And yet, Northeast Minnesota, we know in November that the weather up there can be rather dicey. I'm sure they've gone through some struggles in terms of making it to the polling places on Election Day in years past. I was amazed to read in Minnesota history that the 1936 major national election took place in very, very harsh conditions in Minnesota, single-digit temperatures, 19 inches of snow in places, strong winds, and yet we had a 1.1 million voter turnout on November 3, 1936, which I thought is kind of a marker of what Minnesota is known for in the first place, which is we tend to vote, more consistently in high numbers than most other states.
Well, that's true. Minnesota often leads the country in voter turnout. And one of the reasons that we do that, in addition to culture and a kind of civic tradition, is the fact that the political parties and the candidates put a lot of money into voter turnout. And that's one of the ways in which the candidates and the campaigns can play a role. If they see bad weather's coming, and 36 is probably a good example, the parties can make a particularly strong effort, either by providing transport or, you know, really checking up on people to give them that extra encouragement to go out and vote.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is Craig Edwards. Has there been any incidences where the polls have stayed open longer due to harsh weather in Minnesota and perhaps some portions of the country where it's just, yeah, it's show-stopping weather and they just couldn't get out, or it just says, well, the voting is over with regardless of the weather?
I'm sure there are. I can't give you an exact example. But there are certainly cases where judges have decided to keep the voting place is open a bit longer. It could be because lines are longer or weather. But the key thing is when there are people in line to vote, those voting places will stay open. We don't kind of slam the door on a voter.
Hmm. So we don't really know, historically speaking here, Larry, in your research and that kind of thing, that any big weather incidents that have been so totally disrupted the outcome of a race that had to be decided in a different method or in a different date or something like that? No tornadic activity anywhere or anything like that in history?
I suspect that there may be a few examples of that, but I couldn't give you specific cases.
Well, it looks like now, you wouldn't know the answer to this question, but these two guys in my studio would know. How's Election Day 2008 shaping up, you guys?
Across our region, Western Great Lakes region, it looks like we might be wet, or at least indications are. I don't think necessarily suggesting harsh weather, Craig, but we might tend towards precipitation on Election Day.
Yeah, we've been dry for about a week now, so it looks like the rain spell is going to sit in on Monday night, Tuesday, but it doesn't look like anything bone-chilling cold. It looks like temperatures will be near seasonal, so nothing to keep people from going to the polls in Minnesota on Election Day. We'll have to watch the rest of the country. I understand there's some key states to our east that we'll have to keep an eye on maybe to see how the weather's going to affect those races.
Okay. And Larry, of course, you'll be watching that too, obviously.
I will. And, you know, you kind of look around the country historically, weather has made a difference. In these very close races, two of the biggest examples, 1960, John Kennedy won by less than 120,000 votes over Richard Nixon, and beautiful weather all over the country probably pushed Kennedy over the top. In 2000, we had that, you know, 500-vote difference in Florida, and we had rain in many of the most important Democratic counties in that state, probably made the difference for Al Gore.
So there you go. So the moral, the lesson to this is get out and vote no matter what. I appreciate it, you guys. Thank you so much. Larry Jacobs, take care of yourself.
Okay, take care, Kathy.
Thanks. That's Professor Larry Jacobs of the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute. It may be springtime in the southern hemisphere, but homeowners in the northern part of the globe have winterization on their minds. Last week, we talked a little bit about wrapping up that getaway cabin. This week, we take on the topic of winter preparation of your homestead. Joining us to discuss how to button up your house for winter is Tim Carter, editor of AskTheBuilder.com website. Tim, thanks for joining us on Jet Streaming. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great, Kathy. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Well, let's start with first things first, I guess. What should a homeowner concentrate on first, inside or outside weatherization?
Well, right now, with the temperatures dropping pretty rapidly, you probably need to work on the inside of your home and trying to defend yourself there, because many of the materials that you work with outdoors have temperature limitations built in, and they will fail or not perform properly if you apply them below a certain temperature.
Okay. So it sounds like I need to go outside first.
Well, that's great. You can go outside first, but only if the temperature's right. I'll give you an example. Maybe you'll frequently hear advice from some experts, like go outside and caulk any cracks.
Right.
Well, that's great if the caulk you apply is not going to freeze that night.
Good point.
You know, so if it's only 40 degrees outside when you apply the caulk and then the temperature drops to 25, you could have some issues.
Okay. Mark Seeley?
Yeah, that's a good point. I've done some of that caulking myself in inappropriate conditions. But I was wondering, you know, up here in Minnesota, we have situations where we need to do some prep on our septic systems, Tim. Do you have any advice in that regard? Sometimes we, in fact, two winters in the last two decades, we've had situations where some septic systems have frozen in Minnesota.
Well, actually, it's kind of interesting, Mark, that you say that. I just moved to New Hampshire, so we get some pretty brutal weather like you get in Minnesota. The trouble with these septic systems freezing sometimes results in the systems where they have to pump the water from the septic tank up to a higher leach field. And where the mistakes happen sometimes are these installers don't provide a drain hole that lets that water, that standing line drain of water back into the tank after the pumping cycle is complete. And you can have this standing column of water in that pump line, and boy, you bet that can be a problem. So I think if you do an autopsy, you'll find that's probably what happened.
This is Craig Edwards. I'd like to move from septic tanks to perhaps more romantic scenes of a fireplace. How
good
about
choice.
That? Yeah. You know, a fireplace, I had one in my house at Indianapolis, and I remember that you'd get the nice fire going in the evening, and then the embers would sit there, and then you had to think about closing the damper and that sort of thing. Is there a certain threshold where you suggest to users of wood-burning fireplaces, the traditional wood-burning fireplaces, that it's energy inefficient to operate that?
Craig, I would say that they're inefficient to operate any time. The trouble is that they consume such vast amounts of energy, in that combustion air. Even if you have an outside combustion air in the fireplace, you'll still get air from the room going up the chimney. And then you exactly hit on the point. You can't close the damper before you go to bed. So all night long, you're drawing air up through that chimney. So they're really just for decoration. If you want to burn wood, I highly recommend that you buy one of these high-efficiency wood-burning stoves. That's really the way to do it.
If you do really like the idea of having a wood-burning fireplace, though, Tim, is there a certain temperature when you're not supposed to use the fireplace because it's just too darn cold?
None that I can think of. Okay. The only problem that you might have is that if it's extremely cold outside and you go to start the fire, the cold column of air in the chimney itself could make smoke come back into the room. So you may have to get a draft going by sticking some burning newspapers like a torch, up above the damper to try to get that bubble of air flowing upwards.
Yeah, I've heard that story that you actually have to, preheat the chimney to get the good smoke plume going straight north.
Oh, yeah,
straight
that cold air weighs a lot, and you're asking that hot air to try to push it out of the way. It can't always do it, and you get a big puff of smoke back in your house.
Yes, I know that. Thank you. that's happened before. Going back to first things first here, obviously you can tell where my mind is in making a list. What are the biggest items that a homeowner should put at the top of that list to get when you start looking at getting things done for winterization?
Well, here's how I look at it, Kathy. I think what's on everybody's mind right now because of this current economic crisis we're in is there's a fixed amount of money. And we need, all of us, need to save money and not waste it. And I think the biggest thing people can do to put on top of their list is go over to the thermostat and turn it down. And I mean turn it down radically. For example, in my home right now where I'm talking to you, the thermostat's set at 58.
What?
58?
58 degrees.
Do you have a wife that tells you that that's not sufficient?
No, she does, but the propane delivery guy just left here an hour and a half ago, and the bill just for the last 7 weeks was $554.
Hmm. Oh, wow. Well,
and we've only been using the furnace for the boiler for 3 or 4 weeks. But here's the thing. I'm completely comfortable, and the reason why is I'm wearing a fleece line, like sheepskin slippers. I've got a long sleeve T-shirt on, and I've got flannel lined jeans. I'm completely comfortable.
Well, and you probably have a nice variety of sweaters too.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And if it gets really, really cold, I'll put a hooded sweatshirt on and wear that in the house. All I'm saying is that if people really want to save money, just use less fuel. It's that simple.
Okay, now if there's a compromise position we can take on this, how about setback thermometers or thermostats where you draw the temperature down maybe to 60 overnight while you're in bed under the covers and then give a little bit of a bump in the morning before you get up and then have that again shut down as you go off to work? How efficient and how much money can we save with a setback thermometer?
Those are fantastic devices, and they pay for themselves in spades over time. I highly recommend that everyone use a good quality programmable thermostat and take the time to do the settings right, to do exactly as you just suggested, because they are highly effective at saving money.
Tim, another question along these lines in terms of savings. What about insulation? Do you feel, is it your experience that most homes are insulated about as well as they can be? Given current construction standards, or do you think there's still some measures that can be taken in that regard?
That's a great question. I think that the newer homes, and I qualify those as any home built after, say, 1985, we had radical changes in the energy code after the oil embargo of the 70s. And those are insulated not too badly, but I really feel that there's still room. And what I really wish would happen is if somehow, some way, the government would release the technology that is in the tiles of the space shuttle. Those tiles are 2 inches thick, and they have an R value of about 2,000. And if we could just get half-inch sheets of that special material, which is all silica, we could have an R factor of 500 on our houses.
I'd like to ask about air exchangers, outside air exchangers that people are using. Is there any efficiency in that, or is that strictly to move air in and out of the house?
Well, the air exchangers, they're trying to improve the air quality inside. And if you just, on commercial buildings, if you look at the commercial building code, they are required to bring in lots of fresh air, which causes big problems in energy loss. But these heat exchangers try to extract, try to temper that air as it's being drawn inside. So they're not a bad idea, but remember what they're used for is just to improve indoor air quality, not so much. They actually are an energy glut. They rob energy from the house, but the offset is that you're getting fresh air indoors.
Which is not a bad thing at all.
No. Exactly. It's not a bad thing. But people need to understand that they don't operate for free.
Okay. So before you go here, Tim, what's the one thing, if you could say one thing that a homeowner should do ahead of winter, what should that be?
I would buy long underwear. I would buy more clothes. It's the best investment you'll ever make.
You're not going to budge from it, are you?
I'm not going to budge from it. I know, Kathy, but I'm serious about this because you should see the radical difference in savings I made on our heating bills by taking this tact, and it really, really is effective. But the other thing is, too, just for those who don't want to do that, they need to seal all the air leaks. In other words, caulk around the windows and doors, even inside. If it's already too cold outside, you can actually caulk where the woodwork touches the wall and touches the door or window frame. Check the weather stripping. Make sure you have minimal air leaks. Air infiltration is an enormous energy thief in the home. But really, really, turn those thermostats down, and you'll be shocked at how much you save.
I'm okay with the caulking. I still have to really think about walking around with a fleece and, like 15 sweaters on.
Take a copy of your last utility bill and put
it in
as you walk around.
Yeah, well, I show that to my wife. Well, I just want to finish up with saying, does there anything that lowers your susceptibility to colds by keeping a house at 58 degrees? People say, well, you're going to get more colds and you're going to be more ill due to chilliness around the house.
Well, okay, I don't think I'm qualified to answer that because I'm not a physician, but I can tell you that one of the things that I've noticed that you can actually tolerate the cold a lot more if you have a radiant heating system rather than a forced air. The radiant heating systems at a lower temperature, you have far more comfort than you do at a forced air system.
Okay. Tim, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show, and I'd come back anytime.
We will have you anytime. That's Tim Carter, editor of the AskTheBuilder.com website. Oh, friends, we're not going to hear that much anymore, at least for some people across the country might not hear thunder for the next, several months.
Some of those southern states. Maybe.
Yeah, they might. We won't, that's for sure. Let's see here. Mark Seeley, let's go to you for the weather website of the week.
Well, we haven't highlighted this before, Kathy, but it's a good time to do so. The NOAA Office of Climate, Water, and Weather Services has a wonderful website on winter weather safety and awareness. That's weather.gov/om/winter.
Okay.
I'm sure some of our listeners have probably already been there, but the timeliness feature is important in this case because it's going to give you all the background in terms of what we've just talked about in terms of preparing for winter. What some of the winter hazards are, and some of the National Weather Service products that you may want to pay particular attention to during the winter season.
All right. Thank you so much. That sounds like a great weather website of the week. By the way, don't forget, you can always drop us a line for a question or comment by way of the Jet Streaming webpage at minnesotapublicradio.org. That's going to do it for Jet Streaming this week. For Mark, Craig, Paul Huttner, producers Jim Bickle, P. Ray Rudolph, and ace sound guy Scooter Hibzinski. I'm Kathy Werzer. Thanks for listening, and remember to keep an ear here to Jet Streaming and your weather eye on the sky.